review for me again what you see as your objective for this morning.
Okay. This is February 2nd, 1999. This is an interview with Dr. Abby Marlatt in her residence in Lexington, Kentucky, and the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. Should I call you Dr. Marlatt?
Whatever feels comfortable to you is fine with me.
Okay. Could we begin, please, by you telling me about some of your personal background, for example, when and where you were born, your growing up, your family, your education?
Well, I'm not a native Kentuckian. Mm-hmm. I was born in Kansas, mm-hmm. at Manhattan, Kansas, December 5th, 1916, mm-hmm. and I was an only child. I went to elementary school in Manhattan, just three blocks from my home.
Manhattan, Kansas.
Mm-hmm. And then to the junior high and high school there. Mm-hmm. And then since the college was all Kansas State University now, is only three blocks in another direction from my house, mm-hmm. it never occurred to me from the time I was in kindergarten that I wouldn't complete my education by going through college, mm-hmm. Which I did, and that occurred. I graduated from college in 1938. Mm-hmm. My major was in the general area of home economics, specifically dietetics and institution management. This meant that in order to be qualified as a dietitian, it was necessary for me to take a year's internship after my collegiate degree, and for that I went to the University of California at Berkeley to their certificate program, and entered that in January of 1939, and finished the certificate in 1941. Having also taken some graduate work at in nutrition and dietetics, mm-hmm. there. And then Dr. Agnes Faye Morgan, who was head of the department there at the time, said, well, now, you don't need to stop now. You're well on your way to a PhD. Why don't you just go ahead and study, and we'll give you a teaching assistantship, and you can work for your degree. So that was what I did, and I was there until the summer of 45, when I had almost all my work done, and all except for writing my dissertation. So then I took a position back at my alma mater, and my first real teaching position was as an assistant professor of foods and nutrition at Kansas State University.
Tell me about your parents.
My father was a native of Manhattan. His father had homesteaded there in the mid-1800s. And my mother was born in Illinois. Her parents migrated to Nebraska and then finally to California. And she grew up in California. My father was born in 1867, my mother was born in 1877. So at the age of about 11, when she was 11, the family went by train from Nebraska to California, mm-hmm. 3-day trip, mm-hmm. and there were 7 children in the family, one of them a baby in arms. Can imagine how this was on a coach, yeah. with those woven grass seats, right. All taking all the food you needed along with you.
I understand.
Then she went ahead and became a teacher, an elementary teacher, mm-hmm. there, and then was persuaded by a brother-in-law a little later that when he had gone to Boston to take theological training, and her sister was lonesome so far from all her friends in California to be in Boston, Massachusetts was a long way away. So my uncle persuaded my mother to come to Boston and live with them and help his wife not be so homesick, also take care of the children. And in the meanwhile, he held out the carrot that she could go to Simmons College, which was then offering a 2-year course in domestic science. And so she finished that course, and then she was qualified to teach at the college level in courses related to foods particularly. And she found there was an opening at Kansas State Agricultural College and looked at the map and thought, well, that's about halfway back home to California. I can do this jump now and I'll do the next jump, you know, in a few years. But when she got to Kansas, she met my father, and 5 years later, they were married.
And she
and so she settled in Kansas.
Right. I understand that some of your family back in the 19th century may have been involved in the abolition effort.
Well, my grandfather, whose name was Washington Marlatt, my paternal grandfather, actually, as a young man in eastern Indiana, was trained partly as a minister. He had a classical education, and then at what was then Asbury University, later Asbury DePauw, and now DePauw University. And after he had farmed on his father's farm for a year or so, had enough money put aside with good harvest, that he decided that he would go out to Kansas and see what it was all about, because about 1854 or so was the great push after the Kansas-Nebraska Act to try to see whether they were going to have more settlers who were pro-slavery or anti-slavery, and the territories were going to decide for themselves whether they were going to be slave or free. So he made the trek all by himself, first on a riverboat down the Ohio River and up to St. Louis, and then across from St. Louis to Kansas City, Missouri River, and from there, Wyandotte then, made arrangements with a group who were going to settle in what later became Zinedale, which is Waubonsie County, just next to east from Riley County, which is where Manhattan is now. And walked out with them. This was a wagon train taking a group of settlers out. This was Beecher's Bible and Rifle Group. So they were from New England states. He had the money that he, in gold coins, in his belt around his waist. Managed to keep it too, but he sort of, you know, walked at the end and looked out for stragglers and kept trail on who was following them and so forth. And so, after several days, they arrived at the site that they had picked out for their community. And he, and out of courtesy, asked the leader, and how much do I owe you for the privilege of walking with you? And thought that the man would say, oh, well, you've been of service to us and there's no charge. But the man said, that'll be $10. So he had to shell out one of his $10 gold pieces to pay for the privilege of walking with him.
Wow.
He looked at land and picked out a site that he thought he might homestead, and built some sort of a little shack and settled in for the winter. But after I don't know whether he ever grew a crop on that land or not, but he decided that it wasn't really what he was looking for. And so he shopped around some more and walked all the way from the side of Manhattan out toward Abilene, which is another 60 or 80 miles west, to look at land there, and then came back and got a homestead on what is now called College Hill, just to the northwest of main downtown Manhattan.
And how did he become involved in anti-slavery?
The reason he came to Kansas was that he was hoping to help make it a free state.
Okay.
And he at least used to recount, this is secondhand because my father told me, that on the boat coming up from St. Louis to Kansas City or Wyandotte, there were lots of slow pro-slavery people who were shooting off at the mouth, and he just decided to keep quiet and not say anything, since he obviously was in the minority.
Okay.
And now, what out of except for being interested in politics and making sure that his vote counted, and during the Civil War, when the raiders came in from Missouri and rampaged over Lawrence, there was the possibility that they might come farther into Kansas. And so the militia, of which he was a part, were mobilized, and my grandfather then walked the 60 miles to Topeka to be ready with his unit to defend Topeka, which I think by then was the capital, against the raiders who were coming in from Missouri. But the threat passed by and they demobilized and he walked back home. But on the grounds that he was in the unit ready to act, He then was recognized as a veteran of the Civil War.
I'm impressed with how much detail you have about him that far back. I take it somebody's done some good genealogy or some good record keeping.
My father and one of my uncles was particularly interested in this, yes.
Mm. How about any of the women before all you right. and your family?
Okay, now how did my grandmother, Washington Marlatt's wife, come into the picture? Where did she come from? Well, my grandmother, Julianne Bailey Marlatt, was born in Connecticut, and Gales Ferry, which is on the Thames River, not too far from submarine base now, and she was educated quite well for her time. She went to a girls' academy where she learned languages and writing and some science, and learned to draw and to paint, and was very much interested in things like botany and biology and this sort of thing. And I suspect, now I'm not sure, my feeling is probably she was a school teacher there in that general area. And one of her former professors at the academy, which was East Greenwich Academy, which was actually in Northwest Rhode Island, had joined the abolitionist movement of getting people to go from New England out to Kansas. And he came through that area recruiting people, and in 1859, what they were doing was trying to establish a post-eighth grade educational institution in the Manhattan area, which they were calling a college, but essentially it took you beyond the eighth grade. And he was looking for a teacher. And it occurred to him that Miss Bailey might be a possible candidate, since she had no family responsibilities. So he prevailed upon her to make this trek out to Kansas. By then, I believe they were able to, there were trains that came at least to Kansas City, I think. And she was properly chaperoned by her mother, who came with her, along with Mr. Goodnow and Isaac T. Goodnow. She then lived in the building that had been up on the second floor, the building that had been built as this new Bluemont Central College, so-called, which was just catty-cornered across the road from where my grandfather had homesteaded and where he'd built a cabin. And he, my grandfather, was designated as the principal of this new college, and she was designated as the second teacher. And after they had taught together for the year beginning in 1860, I guess, through that spring and then the following year, in May of 1861, they were married in that Bluemont College building. And I think the reason they were married was that he'd come to sort of the end with the other trustees of this school, and his thinking was not the same as theirs, and he decided that he couldn't be a principal there anymore. But since he was a Methodist minister and had a certificate as a deacon, he could get a position as a settled minister. And he got one in Atchison, Kansas, on the Missouri River, right there on the east side. So they took all their belongings and moved to Atchison.
Okay.
And that was where their first two children were born. Then they moved back to that. He discovered that being a minister wasn't very lucrative, especially when the congregation decided that since he had been enterprising enough to make his own garden so he could grow some of the food he needed, that they could take the cost of the food off of the amount of cash they were going to pay him for the year for salary. The total amount of cash was going to be $500. And they removed some of that because he'd produced some of his own food.
That Methodist tradition, did it continue in your family?
Yes.
Did you grow up?
Yes, I grew up in the Methodist Church, yes. Okay. And my grandfather, beside having that one settlement that I know of, also was a circuit rider for the whole area around Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And as a little girl, I went to one of the rural churches in the county just east of Riley County, which was Waubonsa County, to a Pleasant Run Methodist church. They were having their annual celebration, and everybody who'd ever been associated with it tried to come back, you know, for the reunion. And so they invited my father and his family to come, since he was the son of their first circuit rider who helped them establish the church in the beginning.
In your growing up, Were you involved in any social justice issues that you recall?
By the time I was in high school, I was certainly aware of social justice issues. We had a very excellent social studies teacher in high school who alerted us to some of the issues. And then when I was in college, I became quite active in the student Christian movement, YMCA, YWCA, and I had several positions in the YWCA, including being chairman of the college chapter for a couple of years. And we did several kinds of projects. In the biggest one, I can't remember that as an undergraduate I really was involved with any specific activity locally. The issues then had to do with the students who were trying to scrape together enough money to go to college. Since this was in the depth of the Depression, I started in 34. And so there was the Independent Student Union, which was an organization of those students who wanted some social life but couldn't afford to belong to fraternities and sororities. That was quite an active organization.
The National YWCA, of course, historically has had as one of its major missions the elimination of racism. And in the South, of course, had early on separate YWCA programs and whatnot.
And I realize in Lexington, the Villa Sweetly Y was an effort in this direction. Mm-hmm. And of course, the YMCA also had two different facilities.
In your growing up, did you attend school with African Americans?
All right, good question. Our schools were, of course, neighborhood schools, and by the time I came along, our small African American population in Manhattan did live in a specific area, and there was an elementary school which was designated for them. So it was a segregated elementary school, mm-hmm. named Douglas Elementary School, probably from Frederick A. Mm-hmm. But at the junior high level, there weren't enough people to maintain education on a segregated basis beyond that. So at the seventh grade, we all came together. Mm-hmm. So through junior high and high school, everybody went to the same school. But since the social patterns had already been set, African Americans tended to keep to themselves. We saw them in class, but I can't say that we really got personally acquainted with people of African American origin.
Were any of your family involved in partisan politics along the way?
Not specifically. There was a year when my father agreed to be a candidate for mayor of the city. He wasn't elected. Riley County at that point was 98% Republican, I would say. Okay. And Kansas has been primarily Republican. Occasionally, they're able to elect a governor who is a Democrat. Mm-hmm. But I was not aware of even knowing any Democrats until my college days, I guess, probably.
So your family even voted Republican?
Oh, yes.
Okay. How did you get to Kentucky?
All right. Well, we left me, I guess, at the point where I came back to Kansas State after I finished my graduate work, and I did then go back to Berkeley in the summer of 1946, after I'd been in Kansas a year, and did work on my dissertation, and it was then awarded, the PhD degree was awarded in 1947, actually. And I stayed on as a on the faculty in both in teaching and research at Kansas State from when I got there in 1945 until 1956. And during that beginning in 1947, 48, I guess it was, federal laws enacted permitted some research related primarily was to be used in how we could make use of surplus commodities, but it actually worked out that we could study the nutritional status of various population groups, and this was a cooperative project with several states involved, and I mean research staff and various states in the north central region. And so Kansas State worked with University of Nebraska, Iowa State, University of Missouri, Illinois, Purdue, Ohio State were all involved in cooperative research. Trying to think, I guess Minnesota was also involved in this. The group I worked with was particularly interested in nutrition of school children, and so we set up some projects going into the schools and trying to measure the nutritional status and find out what their eating habits were and see what kinds of educational programs we could devise which would improve the health of the children.
Did the African American community have a very large population in Kansas at that point?
No.
Okay.
Now, by the time World War, as I was growing up, the answer is no. I think World War II, with the various war industries, airplane industry around Wichita, and some of the other large industries, brought in more African Americans than had been there previously.
So you were in Kansas in 1954 when the Brown decision came down.
Well, as a matter of fact, I wasn't. Because in 1953-54 I took a sabbatical, and I spent that year in Beirut, Lebanon. So I actually wasn't in the United States at the time that decision came down.
Do you remember hearing about the decision at all? Remember sort of the climate around you, you know, your friends, your families, sort of what they thought of the decision at all?
No.
Okay.
Of course, by then I had already, I was going to say that one of the experiences, which was a high point in my collegiate experience, was the YWCA sponsored summer service project in New York City, in which about 36 young people from colleges throughout the United States came for the summer to work in various social service agencies in New York City and have special seminars to introduce us to all the social issues that they were seeing at the time. It was very well done. And I had friends who were, you know, at Henry Street Settlement and various other settlements. Actually, I my job was as assistant manager and substitute manager in a girl's residence called Alma Matthews House, which is on West 11th Street. Really downtown in the village. And my job was to help plan the meals, and the girls cooperate who were living there. There were about, I guess, 8 or 10 girls who lived there. They were to plan the meals and buy the groceries for them, since they were hopefully working during the daytime, and then it would be ready for them to cook when they came home to have their cooperative meal in the evening.
I see. So you came to Kentucky in what year?
56.
56. And tell me about that.
All right. I was being urged by the dean of our college to, you know, think about an administrative position rather than pure teaching and research. So I had, and I think my name had been sent out, you know, unless several people who were looking for new directors of schools or deans of colleges and home economics. And I had several interviews, and I came to the University of Kentucky for an interview. Dr. Stady Erickson, who'd been here since the late 20s, was retiring in 56, and we came to a meeting of the minds, and I accepted their offer. And my position was director of the School of Home Economics, which at that point was part of the College of Agriculture and Home Economics. Is it working?
Yes, we're okay. Okay. Just take a minute. I'm going to stop. In 1956, Kentucky was still a very segregated society.
Yes. But the buses had just been desegregated. Mm-hmm. So
the city buses?
City bus system in Lexington. People were concerned about the fact that there was no place in downtown Lexington outside of the cafeteria at the YWCA where any person of color could sit down to eat food. People, and of course, at that time, Main Street was the major shopping center, the major source of activity in Lexington, and the big department stores. Primarily Stewart's, but also Lowenthal's and Grant's, and some of the specialty shops were there, and of course the Woolworths and McCrory's and a couple of the other variety stores had lunch counters, and at least one or two of them would prepare food in a bag to take out if you stood at the end of the counter and asked for it. And some African Americans did that, but they would have liked to have sat at the lunch counter and eaten like everybody else. And it was at that time that some of the students at UK, particularly through the YM and YWCAs, decided that they would like to do something about changing this. And I had had previous experience in California, where with working with the American Friends Service Committee and the Fellowship of Reconciliation, some of us had had training in nonviolent direct action and some of the early efforts of CORE, first trained by Byard Rustin, who was out there, to do some training.
You were trained by Byard Rustin?
Yes.
Oh, you have to tell me about that at some point.
So then when I got to Kansas as a teacher, again I was on the board of the YWCA, and the students in both organizations, YM and YW, decided they would like to do something about eating facilities in the little shopping center just off the corner of the campus, which was known as Aggieville. There was no problem if you wanted to eat on campus, of course, but you know, if you'd like to eat in the drugstores and the variety store in this little shopping center. And so with some of the students, we actually sat in at two of the most popular drugstores there, tried to get them to change. So with that kind of experience then, when I came to Kentucky, and in 59, there was an interest in doing something about the fact that in those establishments that serve students around the periphery of the campus, there was really no place that would serve African Americans. And it was in the late spring of 59 that several students decide that they would test out the little eatery that was at the corner of Columbia and Rose, where the faculty club is now, and see. And Charles Smith, who had just returned after graduate work in Europe, but who was the son of the minister of the Shiloh Baptist Church and brother to William Smith and several other Smith brothers who are ministers here in town. Bill Smith has been with YWCA for many years. But Charles led us, and I, as a faculty sponsor of the Y, was involved. And we soon discovered, no, we would not be served as a mixed group going into this little place. Well, we tried to talk with the manager, and no meeting of the minds came about. And about then, the semester. I think it was during the summer that some of us met and decided that maybe when we began in earnest, when the students came back in the fall, a major concern might be downtown rather than just around the campus. So we really gave up trying to do anything right around the campus and went to the variety stores downtown.
Okay. Let me stop. How many African American students approximately were attending the University of Kentucky at that point? Were there any in the home ec program, for example? Or
I'm not sure there were any African American students. Can't quite remember. There've only been a few over the years.
Okay.
And there were a relatively small number of African-American students in UK at that time.
I want to go back to the local YWCA, which you said was downtown, and I believe I heard you say their cafeteria was integrated.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Did, were you involved enough with them at that time to know whether people supported that integrated cafeteria, people opposed it? Did they just kind of leave them alone, or how did that work?
Actually, I had very little contact with it, except that in 1961, when we were planning an annual meeting of the Lexington Corps, and had invited James Farmer to be the speaker, we were looking for a place to have a banquet. And the only place in central Lexington appeared to be the YWCA, and they did agree that they would open up and prepare a meal for the night. I think their cafeteria were operated primarily at noon time.
The core chapter here started, I believe, in 1959.
Yes.
Can you sort of describe how that came about? Were you involved
yes.
in the beginning?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Students from UK, as I say, primarily from the Y's, and some other young people who were involved with the NAACP were interested. We were able to recruit several young people who were high school age at the time, really, primarily from Dunbar High School. And I think it was primarily by word of mouth and friendship that the nucleus group got started. And several other ones who were active, including Miss Julia Lewis, who at that time was a registered nurse working at Eastern State Hospital, and who was a good friend of Audrey Grievous, who was at that time the president of the NAACP. Audrey is the sister of Robert Jefferson, our councilperson. And she recently retired after a long career as a public school teacher. Audrey was interested, and she got Julia interested in working in it, and Julia went into it heart and soul, and for several years was the president of the core chapter. And Julia was a very active member of the Pleasant Green Historic Baptist Church, so that she involved several people from that church, including the family of the pastor, Dr. Jones. And so several, two of his sons and his daughter were very active in the movement.
So the early core chapter here had approximately how many members?
It varied, but we met weekly, and I would say the meetings had anywhere from 6 to 10 to 12 people. It was very small, really.
Okay.
Now, people at faculty and some students at the college, which was then the College of the Bible, Lexington Theological Seminary now, and the Episcopal Theological Seminary were quite active.
Okay. So it had a almost an ecumenical
yes.
basis to it. Did you have any ongoing contact with other chapters around the state or the country, or that work?
Some with the national headquarters, and I can't remember ever having met, for example, with representatives of other chapters. No.
Okay. And the national headquarters was in New York City, I believe.
It was in New York at the time.
Okay. Did you receive mailings from the national office?
Yes.
Newsletters and...
And materials.
Materials. Mm-hmm. So they were there to support you with information.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of the early members, Dr. Marlette, how did they break down in terms of gender?
Maybe a few more women than men, but about half and half.
Okay. And how at your weekly meetings, you discussed issues and
discussed strategy and action for that week. Primarily, discussed the results of the action the previous week and planned action for that week and strategies that would be followed, yeah.
And Julia Lewis was the first president. I believe you were the first secretary.
I could have been.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that women held visible office in the chapter. What were the relations like between the men and the women? Very cooperative. And when it came to assigning responsibilities for who would do what, how did that work out?
For the negotiating teams, I think there were almost always at least one man on the negotiating teams. When we had to go talk with the managers about their policy and urge them to change their policy. Representatives of the Lexington Theological Seminary included Dr. Lewis Smith and his wife, Dr. Margaret Smith, who was also the student health physician at Berea College. They came back to the United States after a number of years of being missionaries in China. Smith is spelled S-M-Y-T-H-E. And he was a very well thought of professor at Lexington Theological Seminary and was very active in the Christian Church. And one of the theological students there was Dan Garrison, and he was very active in the group over several years. He was white.
And the Smiths were white.
Yes. Now, from Lexington Theological Seminary, it was David Branson, B-R-A-N-S-O-N. B-R-O-N-S-O-N, I guess, Branson. Okay. Who was on the faculty there. And I think from time to time there were students, but I don't specifically remember them.
Did the chapter grow in numbers over time, or did it always
there remain? Was a, as I recall, a fairly small nucleus, but now when we planned special events, you could bring in many more people, and what we did was recruit from the various churches that had African-American membership, of course.
Tell me about the, I think, 1961 meeting that you had.
There was an annual meeting, right. And as I say, a dinner meeting at which James Farmer had been invited to come in as the national speaker.
Okay, and do you remember how large of a group
I guess
group
it would probably, maybe 100 people or more, yeah.
Okay.
It filled filled the room we had anyway.
Can you talk about some of the specific program and strategies that the chapter undertook in those early years?
Our first efforts had to do with lunch counters in the variety stores, and the idea was first of all to discover what the situation really was. You'd had rumors and people had reported that they weren't served. It was, let's find out. So you would send in a team of at least three and preferably 4 to 6 people, mixed black and white, who would attempt to sit at the lunch counter and attempt to order, and the Caucasians were agreed that they would defer to the blacks, and unless the blacks were served, they wouldn't be served either. Mm-hmm. Or in some cases, they attempted to share their food with their partners. They weren't, but and if they weren't served, they would sit there for a designated length of time waiting to be served. Mm-hmm. And since this, and the students had time at lunchtime, and that was when we did it, and that was, of course, the heavy time for the lunch counters downtown, so you really occupied several of their spaces, and people were waiting to be served, and here they weren't serving you, and you were occupying a seat. And when you discovered that, well, the first, of course, attempt, when obviously you weren't being served, then we tried to contact the manager and set up a time when team might go see the manager, talk about the policy and the fact that it would be to his advantage to serve everyone, and so on. And then if you got a negative, then you plan to have sit-ins in which over a number of days throughout the week you would try to get in with several people who would occupy seats at the lunch counter and demand and ask for service.
Was there ever any arrest?
No. I don't believe there ever were at lunch counters. We had the foresight to talk with the chief of police ahead of time about what we had in mind and what we were trying to do, and that it wasn't nonviolent. And this was Chief Hale, who was a native Lexingtonian, who grew up on Winnie Street, just by the Lexington Theological Seminary. And he was amenable to trying to maintain order, and therefore if there were hoodlums who were going to try to cause trouble, he would see that police were there to keep the hoodlums from causing trouble.
Of the people who participated in the sit-ins, it was a mixed group racially?
Yes.
And again, how did it tend to break down in terms of men and women?
There probably were more women than men, but there was always a good smatter in the fellows.
Why do you think that might be, that there were more women than men?
Well, I don't know that I really ever analyzed it, whether women were more aware of discrimination because as the minority sex they felt discriminated against? I don't know. And therefore, they also related to the other discrimination. This is maybe a part of it.
Okay. And was the core chapter working with the local NAACP this time?
The relationships were fairly cordial in terms of working together for rallies and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
But were the NAACP members actually involved in the sit-ins with you?
Yes, and if you interview Audrey Grievous, you will discover that she has a very interesting tale, which you may have already heard.
No.
We were at H.H. Green's, which was one of the variety stores, and Mr. Weisenberger, who was the manager, we were there one Saturday, I think, and the lunch counter was over at the side toward the back, and so you walked through part of the store to get to the lunch counter, and this was after we had attempted to fill his lunch counter with patrons several times, so that he decided to put up a chain fence designation separating the lunch counter from the rest of the store. And then he stood at the end and let people into the lunch counter area. And there was a long end of his, it was a steel chain that was hanging there. And as he stood there, he swung the chain. And Audrey was the first in line, waiting to be the next one seated at the lunch counter. And he purposely swung the chain against her legs and did enough damage so that even today she's aware of the injury that was done to her shins.
During this period, were there any, were there outsiders who, let's see, how shall I ask this here? Was there any violence going on in the community in the way of retaliation or expression against what you and the core members and NAACP were trying to do?
The papers, the local, of course, the leader and the Herald were not together yet. There was a morning and an evening paper. The Herald was a morning paper, and the leader was the evening paper, as I recall. and their editorials were rather antagonistic. And the Mr. Walks was what? Publisher? At that point, I think. And he was personally very much opposed to what was the disruption in the downtown that was happening. And obviously these were communist-tinged people who were causing all the trouble.
Mm-hmm. How about your the university administration and your colleagues? How were they receiving you in terms of your involvement with all of this?
Yeah, I felt that if my involvement were out of school hours, that it was my privilege to do as I felt I needed to do. The people in the school, some of them were sympathetic to what I was doing, but not sympathetic to the point where they would have joined me. Others were very antagonistic and felt that I was damaging the school and that they really wanted to distance themselves from me because of this.
And did they tell you that?
In body language, yes.
In body language, okay. Was there any involvement of the KKK or White Citizens Council here?
Teenage hoodlums, I would think, were white teenage hoodlums were more involved in. I don't remember any specific activity that could have been assigned to KKK.
Okay. So after the sit-ins, what happened next for CORE?
Well, you asked a question which I really didn't answer, was what did the university administration think of this? And what action did they take, if any? Dr. Dickey was the president at that point, and I was called into his office one day, and he said that he thought I should be aware that my activities were impacting negatively on the finances of the university, because some of the businessmen downtown were refusing to give their usual contributions because of activities of some of the faculty and students against businesses downtown.
And other than letting you know this, did he...
He did not threaten me in any way.
Did he recommend to you that you...
I'm sure that he hoped I would say I would cease and desist. I think I told him that I believed that desegregation was the thing which was right and should happen in the community, and that I felt I needed to be involved in seeing that it happened.
So other than the sit-ins, how else was the CORE chapter involved here during those years?
Some of the people were then involved with movie theaters. And on the north side of Main Street, there was the Ben Ally, and there was another one, was it the Palace? I can't quite remember. And then, of course, the Kentucky Theater, where it is now. The Ben Ally and the other one on the north side of Main Street both had balconies, I believe. Now, you'll have to get this from somebody else. And therefore, blacks could attend, but they came in by the back stair and into the balcony and not on the main floor. So what the group decided to do was to stand in line for tickets and to intersperse blacks along the line so that, and if they were told they wouldn't be served or they couldn't buy a ticket there, or you would say, well, I'll wait for my friend was here first, I'll wait for him to get a ticket before I buy a ticket. And at that time, some arrests were made for blocking the sidewalk, this kind of thing. And some of the young people were taken into custody and then released. Some of them might have spent overnight in jail, I'm not sure. And some of us on this were involved with bailing them out.
With the arrest of both black and white participants?
I think there may have been, but I'm aware one specific persons I'm aware of who were arrested were black. And I'm a little fuzzy about how many people were involved in. And then, of course, after we worked on the theaters, and, of course, the final result of these activities was passing of ordinances by both the city and the county for non-discrimination in public accommodations. And after that, then, young people began to work on employment opportunities. And Stewart's had their big store downtown then. and they realized that Stewart's, I think, didn't have any clerks who were black, and they felt that if blacks were buying products there, there should be blacks employed in positions other than janitor or elevator operators. And so they did picket that, and that did lead to some. Distinctly when we celebrated at the Kentucky Theater with a big theater party in which we got 25 or 30 people all to go to the Kentucky Theater so we could all sit together in the Kentucky Theater and see, I think it was Oliver Twist. It was on.
Okay. Now the local ordinance that you all were successful in having enacted, was that before the 1964 Civil Rights Act?
I believe so.
It was. So
now you might need to check this right. And see, I'm a little fuzzy about right. The date. Yeah. And of course, Bart Peak, who was the county judge at the time, had been the YMCA director at UK before he retired and decided to run for county judge. So he was very sympathetic with the efforts of the group. Mm-hmm. I don't remember specific personalities on the city council at that point, because this was prior to the merger.
Mm-hmm. Now the judge was white himself?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. The merger happened...
67, I think.
Okay. The merger of the city
and
the
county government.
Okay. Okay. I understand also that there was a demonstration against the city newspaper, I believe in 1963, that CORE sort of provide the leadership for. Do you have any recollection of that? Again, around employment issues.
No, I don't.
Okay. About economic boycotts of stores that refused to enter?
They did try that. I think that was an effort primarily by the black community. I don't remember how much of the total community might have been involved with this. Might say, though, in terms of total community, this activity of CORE and the activists did gain support from various church groups who finally organized as the Lexington Committee on Religion and Human Rights, which was very active in the early 60s, and met at the YMCA on east of West 2nd Street, Jefferson, what's now Jefferson Place, which was originally the nurse's home for St. Joseph Hospital, when St. Joseph was where the housing public housing project is now. They met very actively and could be counted on for support for mass meetings and for general support and efforts to change the opinions of government officials and so on.
Were you part of that group also?
Yes, but I wasn't a leader in that group.
I believe there was a woman named Laura Massey.
Yes.
Who was their general secretary.
Yeah, that was Mrs. William Massey.
What can you tell me about her? I don't know anything at all.
Well, I think she was a member of the Second Presbyterian Church and a very lovely person. And I don't know whether she was active on the board of the YWCA, although she might have been. but she was a very strong, motivating force who got was able to garner in a lot of community support, and her husband, who was an orthopedic surgeon, was well thought of in the community.
Was she?
And she has retired to California, and I understand she's not very well.
Was she originally from Lexington or from Kentucky? Or
I'm not sure. Named? She was a longtime resident. She might have been native, I'm not sure.
Okay. During this time, there was a court chapter, I believe, in Louisville.
I don't remember any real contacts with them.
Okay.
We were aware of some of the activities in Louisville and aware of Martin Luther King's brother, who was a minister in Louisville and who was heading up some of the civil rights activities.
Okay. Did CORE eventually move to having a paid director or some paid staff?
No.
No. What was Ronald Berry's affiliation with CORE?
When we started, probably in 1959, at least by the fall of 1959, he was a student at Dunbar High School, was one of those high school young people who became active. Pat Vinegar was another. I can probably dredge up the names of some other people too.
Pat Vinegar is?
Patricia Vinegar. She also was married, and I'm not sure whether her last name's Thompson now. But
is she still living?
Yes.
And she's in the area?
Yes. She would be a good person to interview. She was the secretary of CORE for several years. She lived over on Spiegel Heights. There were several people whom we recruited from the Spiegel Heights area. Are you aware of Spiegel Heights?
Tell me about that.
It's off Versailles Road just after you cross the overpass on the right-hand side. And it's up the hill from Irishtown.
And
the people who lived on Spiegel Heights looked down their noses at those low-caste people who lived down there in Irishtown.
I see.
The ones up here were black, the ones down here were white.
And Patricia Vinegar lived where?
In Spiegel Heights.
Spiegel Heights, okay. She was white or black?
Black.
Black. So Spiegel Heights was it an integrated community, or was it?
No, it was pretty much black community. Oh, Julia Lewis lived there. The Berry family lived there.
But they were African Americans who were more middle class than.
Yes.
Okay. At what point did CORE sort of cease to see its mission having been completed, and what happened to?
What happened to CORE was Black Power. This came in nationally, and in 1968, I remember very distinctly a meeting at which there were probably 15 or 20 people at the meeting, and there were probably three or four of us who were not black who were at the meeting, and we were told that honkies were no longer accepted and we could leave, thank you.
That was here at a local meeting?
Yes.
And how was that? How did you react to that?
I thought, well, if we've done our best, and if they don't want us, then all right.
Mm-hmm. Who were the other white people, if you remember, that were active with CORE at that point?
Well, the Smiths were still active. Mm-hmm. Can't remember whether Dan Garrison was still active or not.
Okay. Did you all attempt to debate that?
No.
Did you feel, how did you feel about it?
It was a very angry meeting. We just left. Mm. But interestingly enough, within the next year, it was Ron Berry who contacted me and said, I need help. I have this great idea about starting a youth organization, which I'd like to model after the local government, because I think if youth had a feeling about how local government was run and some understanding of it, that there would be less violence and maybe the local government would understand the youth better too if they were to shadow some of the local government people for a certain number of days. In other words, we'll set up a city council and have a mayor and a police force, and we'll run a recreation program and an employment program and motivational program and so forth. And that was the way micro city government got started in 1969.
Mm-hmm. What was your role? How did he said he needed your help? What specifically did he want you to do?
Help him write the proposal.
The proposal. And that it was funded by, was that OEO money or was it?
I'm not well, micro city government has had some grants from various organizations, including some federal grants at various times, some state grants, and then some money from city government. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you thought that was a good idea?
Yeah, he thought he needed my help. I was willing to give it.
Okay. Did you...
Let bygones be bygones and mm-hmm. go on from here.
Did you continue to stay involved in the program?
Yes.
You did. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I've been involved since then. I mean, the first early two or three years of the 70s, probably I wasn't so involved, but I've been on the board of Micro City Government since mid-70s.
Okay. Okay.
The telephone call I had was from Micro City,
okay,
saying that as treasurer, would I please come over and sign some checks today?
Okay. Okay. Tell me about the YWCA during the 60s here. You mentioned
yes
that they were integrated, but were any of the leaders or members involved in
yes.
the civil rights mm-hmm. activity?
Yeah, they were, and names are escaping me at the moment, and they may come back to me, I have to think, but yes, several, and they were very supportive, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about the League of Women Voters?
I wasn't myself involved with the League at that point. They were supportive. And, of course, I think we're staying in the area of voter registration, voter rights, and I'm not sure about what projects they may have done that related to this, except that one of their members was very much involved in trying to get an open housing agency going, and that could have come out of a project from the League of Women Voters, I'm not sure.
Was there a local human relations commission?
All right, thank you for bringing it up. Out of this effort in the early 60s, Bart Peak, as the county judge, was set up, and I'm not sure whether I should say agreed to set up, whether he had the idea, a county human rights commission to see if we could use this as the agency that would try to bring people together.
Mm-hmm. And were you in?
Hear differences and, right, you know, so forth.
Right. Were you involved with that in any way?
No. Going back to the Lexington Commission on Religion and Human Rights, Harry Sykes was very much involved with it, and as a very well thought of member of the black community, having been on what was the Harlem Globetrotters, I think, mm-hmm, among others, and then a teacher in the schools, and then later he became city manager, mm-hmm, and I guess eventually the vice mayor.
Okay.
And he's still around, and you should interview him about some of these things.
Okay. I want to go back to Julia Lewis. Was she the president of CORE? Was she still involved in CORE in 68 when
Julia
came in?
I'm not quite sure of the dates, but along about the mid-60s, Julia, having done her thing here, went to Michigan, East Lansing, I think, and was involved with community development organization there for several years, mm-hmm, and didn't come back here until probably the early 80s.
Okay.
And since then was involved with the housing authority, mm-hmm, public housing authority, and you could ask some of them about her activity there.
Did you make any close women friends in particular from the membership of CORE while it was active?
I consider Julia a very close friend.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. How about with any of the men who were involved? Obviously, you've stayed in touch with...
Yes, and of course, I felt that I was sort of a mentor and sponsor for Ronald Berry, mm-hmm, having known him as a teenager and watched him grow and develop over, mm-hmm, the years, and since he has continued to be the executive director of Micro City Government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What happened to the Lexington Committee on Religion and Human Rights?
I think it disbanded in the late 60s.
Okay. Are there any CORE records or photos or...
There may be
stories?
Some, and Ron Berry could help you with those.
That's where they'd be.
We had several, quite a bunch of records, but there have been several moves, and the last I knew, nobody seemed to know where the old records were.
Okay.
But he may have some photo files, at least.
Okay. Okay, I think we're about through for now, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't talked about specifically, but sort of came to mind as we... How would you sum all of this up for yourself in terms of your involvement in the period? And
Yeah, I'm glad I was involved, and it gave me a new insight into Lexington and the various components of Lexington community, certainly. Mm-hmm. I hope made me a better person.
Mm-hmm. Have you continued to be a Methodist?
No. No. When I was a graduate student at the University of California in Berkeley, I became a member of the Unitarian Church there, and then when I came to Lexington, I found there was a Unitarian Fellowship here, and I joined it, and I've been a member since 1957.
Okay. I want to go back and ask you about the reference you made to the American Friends Service Committee. I meant to pick up on that earlier.
When I was a graduate student in Berkeley, California, during World War II, the American Friends Service Committee was very, very active in the area, and was supportive of the fellows who were conscientious objectors to World War II, and especially those who were, and tried to help those who were either going to prison or were going to civilian public service camps. And I was involved in helping to entertain some of the young men who came through on their way up to the various service camps. Mm-hmm. We also were involved with that office in Northern California, was deeply involved in trying to help the people of Japanese origin who, after the orders in January of 42, were evacuated to the so-called relocation centers, mm-hmm. concentration camps up in the mountains and mm-hmm. deserts of Eastern California and mm-hmm. Western Nevada. Mm-hmm. And of course, several of my co-students at at the University of California, mm-hmm. Were among those who went to those relocation centers. Mm-hmm. And several of my friends and I went over to visit a couple of our Japanese friends when they were being held at Tanforan Racetrack as one of the reception centers before they were shipped off.
Mm-hmm. Now, AFSC, I know, had some involvement in some of the other southern states during the civil rights period, Alabama and Mississippi. Were they involved in Kentucky?
I don't know they were involved in Kentucky, but actually the activities which involved the nonviolent direct action mm-hmm. Were held primarily at the old Japanese YMCA on Geary Street in San Francisco, mm-hmm. which was being conserved by the American Friends Service Committee and used as their headquarters during the war, mm-hmm. with the understanding they'd turn it back when mm-hmm. people were able to return.
Have you ever heard of Highlander Folk School?
Yes.
Tell me, have you been
involved? I've not actually visited there. I was aware of the founder, and one of my longtime friends who went to Bank Street College of Education mm-hmm. Regaled me with stories of a field trip which the students from Bank Street took by bus into the South and ended up at Highlander Folk School, mm-hmm. and what a great time they had mm-hmm. and what it was all about. And I have kept up with the kinds of community development they've tried to sponsor and the groups they've given leadership opportunities to over the years. And all their troubles with all the flack in Tennessee about mm-hmm. you're a communist organization and you can't be here, and they got burned out, and I've helped them with their fund to, you know, give them support in case they needed insurance.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they, in the early days of the civil rights movement, and before we even define that, they used to conduct citizenship schools. And I've not been able to find anybody who knows that they came into Kentucky at all, that they seem to have gone more to Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear that they might have? Of course, the citizenship schools were really focused more on voting, getting people to vote and to register to vote, and that was not really a big issue here for the civil rights movement, I take it.
No, not really. I mean, that wasn't one of the things you couldn't do.
Right. So African Americans could vote.
Yeah. You might ask some people who are long-term and see if they remember the history, but
okay.
I wasn't aware of that as a problem.
Okay.